Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This hour, we are figuring out what's fair. From pay equity at Starbucks to a French waiter who says he shouldn't have been fired for being rude. It's not fair, he says. He's French. We're going to begin with what is fair when it comes to transgender people and the U.S. military. Washington State has sued the Trump administration for trying to ban transgender people from serving in the armed forces. Several federal judges blocked the ban last year, including one in Seattle. So Trump modified his order last week. He watered it down a little. And yesterday, that Seattle judge took another look. I asked Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson about it earlier today. You want transgender people to serve in the military. What did this Seattle federal judge indicate yesterday?
Yeah, we want transgender individuals to be treated like everybody else, not be discriminated against. And so we had a hearing yesterday before Judge Peckman, a federal judge here in Seattle. And what we are asking is for the judge to declare that ban against transgender individuals to be unconstitutional. We have an injunction stopping it, but now we're seeking to have it declared unconstitutional. President Trump, as you know, late last weekend put together some changes to the policy. The Trump administration said, well, we've done this study. We think for the readiness of our troops, we need to have this ban in place. From our standpoint, though, at the end of the day, what this case is all about is discriminating against transgender individuals who want to serve. Judge Peckman made a good point when the Department of Justice lawyer talked about, well, we need this for troop readiness, that type of thing. She said, look, that's been the argument for opposing racial integration of the military. Right, of having gays serve in the military. She said, I've heard this before. She seemed unpersuaded. So I don't want to predict what she's going to do. But from our standpoint, the hearing went very well.
Well, the Trump administration is arguing when it comes to medical costs about gender reassignment or gender confirmation surgery, among other things. You talked about military readiness. What evidence did the Trump administration produce that transgender service members are bad for military readiness?
Well, this is what's been frankly, what's so frustrating to me and to my team and to the individuals I think who are bringing this case is when the president tweeted out this decision to ban transgender individuals, there was no basis for it. What they've done now is try to find a justification for a discriminatory decision. That's not how the law works. If they've got evidence, they should have had that up front. And Judge Peckman made that abundantly clear in her discussion yesterday. Where's the evidence? Where has it been? You made this decision months ago. Where was the evidence to support that? You can't try to back your way into it long after the decision's made.
Okay, then when this Seattle Judge Peckman make a decision?
We don't know for sure, but the judge gave each side 7 days to provide additional briefing to her. I think she telegraphed that she's prepared to rule relatively quickly, but it's really entirely up to her. But she'll have additional papers in the next week, and then a decision could come anytime after that.
Okay, another lawsuit to talk about. Yesterday, you joined a lawsuit against the Trump White House. The administration says it will resume asking people in the census survey what their citizenship is. This question used to be on the census until 1950. So what is your legal basis for saying it can't be there?
Sure. So we have essentially two arguments. One is a constitutional argument that the Constitution requires counting everybody, not just citizens, everybody. The law is very clear on that. And so we are arguing that by asking whether someone is a citizen, that will depress participation in the census. That's not just my opinion. The past directors of the Census Bureau who have served under both Republican and Democratic presidents have said exactly the same thing. In fact, the Census Bureau's own testing in the past indicates that would be the case. That's number one. Number two, there's a lengthy process for determining what questions go on the census. There's a testing process. It takes years. It's about to conclude at the end of this month. And literally in the last couple months, the Department of Justice asked that this question about citizenship be included. They're adding it and bypassing the normal requirements for testing that question before putting it on the census. You can't do that under federal law. So there's basically two main tracks of arguments we have.
You think that this census question about citizenship would depress the response. Other past census directors agree with you. But what evidence do you have of that?
Well, the Census Bureau itself has tested this. So, for example, in 2010, the Census Bureau looked at asking this question about citizenship. They looked at it. They examined it. And they came to the conclusion that it would actually depress participation.
That's their best guess. I recognize this would be very hard to prove, but it was asked in decades past, do you have evidence to offer that we can see that it dampened response to the census?
Yeah, so the Census Bureau's own testing, their own surveys, suggested they came to the conclusion that this would depress participation in the census. Moreover, even beyond their own testing, these are the experts, right? The heads of this organization under Republican and Democratic presidents, they're the experts. I trust their judgment. But I also think common sense indicates that as well. I think your listeners are well aware of the political environment we have and why individuals who may not be citizens may be reluctant to participate in this. They may not trust the federal government will really keep this information private, and they have good reason to believe that. You look at the case we have regarding Dreamers in this country. Dreamers were assured if they provided their personal information and their undocumented status, that would never be used against them to deport them. The federal government now is taking away those protections and has made no assurances that they won't use that information against those Dreamers to deport them. So with good reason, I think folks are skeptical of that promise from the federal government in today's climate.
And will you remind us what the harm is? Who is hurt by a theoretical depressed response rate? Who is hurt and how?
Yeah, the census is very important. It's not some technical enterprise. What happens as a result of the census are very fundamental decisions. In other words, how many members of Congress each state has is determined based on the number of individuals, not just citizens, who reside in a state. You can gain or you can lose your representation in Congress as a result of the census. Hundreds of programs are federally funded. Running Start, for example. That is based on the number of residents, not citizens, in each state. The more you have, the more funds you receive. The fewer people you have, the fewer funds you receive. So whether you are right of center or left of center or right down the middle, everybody should care intensely about an accurate count, which the Constitution requires, of everybody who lives in the state, not just citizens.
Is President Trump punishing Washington State citizens for you having filed how many lawsuits?
Well, 23 as of today, yeah.
Is he punishing us?
I mean, Bill, that's a hard question to answer. I can't get inside his head to know. And, you know, we'll see as things develop, right? Marijuana legalization. Do the feds try to come in and stop that, for example? What does happen on some of these issues moving forward? I mean, I hope that's not the case, but whatever he chooses to do, it's not going to change my perspective. My job is to hold the president accountable to the rule of law if he's harming Washingtonians. So far, we've been doing that in a variety of cases. So whatever his motives are for doing what he's doing, I don't spend a whole lot of time focused on that. I just try to focus on the law and making sure he's following it.
Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, on my job, I start a bunch of different projects. Some I feel rock solid about. Some of them, this might not fly.
Yeah.
What's the weakest case of the 23 that you've filed against?
Well, there's no chance I will answer that question directly. But I will say is that every case has its own challenges. Anytime you're filing a lawsuit against an administration, there's going to be strengths to your lawsuit and weaknesses. None of these cases are slam dunks one way or the other. That's just by definition how the law works often. And so I don't anticipate that when it's all said and done with our litigation against this administration that we'll win them all. We have so far, but that's not the way the law works. But we don't file a case unless we feel we have good legal arguments, that we have a good case to present before the judge on an issue that impacts Washingtonians. So, yes, in my mind, I'm very aware of which cases are our strongest that we think and which ones are our weakest. But it's worth pointing out, sometimes judges surprise you. So you never really know. Judges are humans. They're people. They focus on different things. And that's the beauty of the law in some respects, is you never know for sure how it's going to turn out.
When people talk about you as a candidate for Washington governor, are you tickled, annoyed, or something else?
I mean, it's just sort of a chuckle. I mean, it's March of 2018. We have a governor Jay Inslee, who I like and respect. I hope he runs for a third term. If he does, I'll be the first one to raise my hand and endorse him and support him. So I'm pretty busy with my job and the 10-year-old twins we have at home with my wife. So it's just not something I'm particularly focused on right now. I got my hands full.
If Jay Inslee doesn't run, Bob Ferguson?
Follow-up question. I'll make that decision when the time comes. I'm a believer in doing that. I think politicians get in trouble when they try to think too far ahead, account for every possible scenario. Focused on the job, let the governor make his decision when he makes it, then I can make mine when the time's right.
Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, thank you for this.
Thank you, Bill.
Welcome back to The Record. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm here with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel. Hiya, Jeannie.
Hi, Bill.
You have been looking into the topic of workplace equity.
Yes, and last week, Starbucks made a really interesting announcement having to do with that. The company is claiming they've achieved pay equity across all races and genders in the United States operation. They're hoping to do this worldwide as well, and that's a pretty big deal, that announcement. I mean, men still make more than women in many industries, and women of color make less than white women. Our next guest, though, is cautiously pleased about this Starbucks announcement. Kristen Rau Finkbeiner, executive director and co-founder of Moms Rising. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So, cautiously pleased. We're seeing a lot of headlines that say Starbucks is claiming they've achieved gender equity in pay, claiming. Who's checking up on this?
Well, fortunately, Starbucks did work with a number of highly respected national women's organizations, including the National Partnership for Women and Family, AAUW, the American Association of University Women, and other organizations that Moms Rising has long worked with to pass positive national policy on pay transparency. So we know they're working with the experts.
Okay. So at a minimum, we know that they're working with the right people on this, and that could be why you're cautiously pleased?
I'm cautiously pleased because we have yet to really see pay parity in the United States of America or anywhere. You know, we've seen things like a recent study of Uber drivers who found that even though supposedly you can't tell it's a gender-blind application to get your Uber, that women drivers are paid 7% less, right? So we're seeing over and over again that the implicit bias that is throughout our culture is really hard to get rid of. So I'm excited that they're working to get rid of it. I'm super excited about the policies that they've put forward that other companies can replicate. And I'm cautiously optimistic that they are actually achieving pay parity, as I also applaud and do a standing ovation and a happy dance.
So if they've actually done what they've said they've done, this is historic, you're saying?
It's absolutely historic. I mean, it is also counter to all of the data that has been coming out. New data came out last week showing that being a mom actually has increased wage discrimination just from last year. You know, and moms are making about 71 cents to a man's dollar nationwide right now, and moms of color are earning even less. So, you know, what Starbucks is doing is up against a giant tide that is pulling women's wages down. And so what they're doing, and I love how they talked about what they're doing as an active form of doing, not just done, right, but doing.
Yes.
Because we're in this culture where pay discrimination is epidemic. It's something that they're going to have to continue to work on every day, every minute, every second, every year to keep pay parity if it's truly been achieved. And either way, I'm applauding, right? Like, it's great to have a company stepping out like this.
Okay, so we know that this is not a thing that you can just do and then be done with it. You don't get to check the box and then never think about pay equity in your company again. But I'm curious what Starbucks has done specifically to try and reach this milestone.
They've done a lot of things that sound super simple and common sense once you hear them, but they aren't used regularly. And what I love about this is that they're transparent about what they're doing. So one of the things is they have decided that they will no longer ask candidates about their salary history. Very important. Because
why is that significant, though?
That's so significant because what we're talking about, the massive wage inequality that's happening right now in the United States of America, women overall making 80 cents to a man's dollar, Latina women making 54 cents, Native American women making 57 cents, Black women making 63 cents, white women making 75 cents, and moms making 71 cents, with moms of color having a double wage hit. Those are extreme wage hits. And so if you have a lifetime of work or even just 2 or 3 years of work in those wage hit situations, your past salary history is going to be depressed by the discrimination that you have already experienced. So having Starbucks come out and say we don't ask candidates about their salary history, instead we're paying them based on their abilities and the job category, is phenomenal and is something that everybody can replicate.
But there are also some of the measures that Starbucks took, which it lays on the shoulders of employees and candidates to do the asking, right? Like, there's one specific one that says job candidates have to ask, but then Starbucks will publish the position pay range. I mean, we live in a culture where it's not really encouraged to talk about money or talk about salary. So how is that supposed to work, where all of a sudden employees and candidates are supposed to just feel comfortable asking those questions?
Well, first, I want to start on a positive. They had a pay range for a salary position. Oftentimes, many places don't have a job title with job responsibilities that are linked to a pay range. It sounds simple, but oftentimes people are making sort of subjective decisions about how much to pay people, right? And so just the very fact that Starbucks now has a job title attached to job responsibilities, attached to a pay range, that's a plus, right? That's something that other people can replicate. Now, having to have people ask for that, I agree, is something where improvement could happen, because we know from other studies, just going back to just the sort of cultural context, that when women ask, when women push, often they get implicit bias and push back against just asking, and they're not seen as being assertive, they're seen as being something else, and it's a word we won't say on air.
Fair enough. Okay, well, you said that this is not a thing that any company could just sort of achieve and then move on from. So leaving aside the idea that sometimes employees and candidates under these new policies are going to have to ask questions that they might not be comfortable with around salary and all of that, how does a company maintain gender pay equity?
I think Starbucks is doing the right thing, actually, by announcing it at their shareholders meeting, talking about it in the media, lifting it up as a victory, you know, making pay transparency part of our common parlance, our common dialogue in this country, in corporations, is huge. You know, at Moms Rising, we've been working for pay transparency for a long time in terms of legislative processes. We just helped pass the Equal Pay Opportunity Act right here in Washington State. It was signed into law last week. I brought with me and I'm writing with my pen from the signing of the bill. I just love it so much. But these are long fights for pay transparency, and to have the change that we really need, there isn't a single silver bullet solution to having pay equity or pay parity. You know, it's going to take a lot of different policies and conversations, and having corporations lead the way in that cultural change is absolutely helpful.
Well, Kristen, I also know that, you know, because you run Moms Rising, you're one of the people who creates policies at your organization to make sure that there's pay transparency and pay equity. So how do you maintain that in your own organization?
We do have a job chart, which I love, you know, and that's why when I saw that wording in Starbucks release about provide positions pay range upon a candidate's request, I was like, oh, I know the work that happened behind that. That means they have a job chart with job responsibilities and a pay range. And it sounds easier to do than it is sometimes. You know, you really have to think about what are the different responsibilities for each different position and different pay levels. It could take a while to do. So I hope everybody listening takes that moment to do that. You know, just list out your job titles, list out the different responsibilities for people's positions related to the titles, and then list out the pay range. And I can guarantee you most people won't have a pay range yet. They're going to have a whole bunch of different people being paid at lots of different levels. And when you list it out that way, you can say, oh my gosh, maybe there's some implicit bias in this pattern, and then do equity raises. So look at raising people's salaries based on that chart rather than based on some more subjective decision making. So yeah, we do that at Moms Rising.
Do you also encourage the people who work at Moms Rising to talk about their salaries?
Well, most people who work at Moms Rising also work on pay transparency. So the short answer is yes. We're talking about pay a lot. One of the things that we forget to do that is important to do, and that we made just sort of like a promise that we would always do it, is in all job announcements. We have yet to put in the pay range for all job announcements. Sometimes we've forgotten in the past couple of years, and then we're like, oh, we have to put in the pay range, you know. So it's really easy steps that lift the organization, lift the corporation, that we can forget to do because they're not the norm. And even we forget to do them because they're not the norm. So it's all a work in process. And that's why I know Starbucks' giant step forward is a giant step forward, but it's the first of many steps forward. So let's think of it as a giant dance forward. We can have a celebration dance that we're moving forward, but it's not the beginning, middle, and end. It's just the beginning.
I'm talking with Kristen Rauf-Finkbeiner. She's the co-founder and executive director of Moms Rising, a public policy advocacy organization. And we're talking about the announcement from Starbucks. They've claimed to have achieved gender and gender equity with their pay and their U.S. operations. They're planning on doing this worldwide as well. And Kristen, pay for the people who are already employed is one issue when it comes to equity, but there's also promotion. There's also hiring. Do you know of any of the work Starbucks has done to ensure that those pieces are also more equitable?
Well, it looks like one of the things that they're really promoting is removing caps on promotion increases. And again, here they're looking at your promotion not being related to what you've made in the past, so not letting past discrimination add up. The other things that they're doing is setting some accountability measures. And all of these things are important. And this is another reason why it's sort of like we're celebrating, but we're not sure exactly what's going on under the hood, because when we talk about what's happening with women in America, one of my favorite studies related to Moms Rising, but it was so interesting because it was out of Cornell University. They did a study of two pieces of paper with resumes on them, identical resumes, identical job experience and education. One just mentioned that somebody was a mom, And they were offered jobs. The mom was offered jobs 80% less of the time than the non-mom. And the mom was offered $11,000 lower starting salary than the non-mom, while dads were offered $6,000 more. And then they also found that moms are judged more harshly in the labor force. And this is important to your question about sort of advancement. They were judged more harshly in the labor force, and they were taken off the management track for fewer late days. Right? So when we're looking at how we're advancing people, we really have to take a look at our implicit bias and our questions and how we're judging people in real time and go back to that chart, you know, your job chart. Are they doing their job? You know, are they meeting their job goals? Are they getting the results we want? And look at that and be careful about, you know, sort of subconsciously judging people, because that adds up over time into a lot of money, you know? Like $800 billion is one of the things that I saw, you know, in the nationally, not just in Washington State.
We only have a minute left, Kristen, but I feel like I'm going to ask you an essay question and then ask you to answer it in a minute. But given that you've brought up implicit bias in hiring, in promotion, in pay a couple of times here, and that we're just at the beginning of Starbucks claiming that they've achieved this thing and they're going to continue to maintain it, how will we know that this is working? Like, what are the benchmarks you're going to be looking for to say, yep, they did what they said?
Well, this is the exciting question that is not an essay question, because Starbucks actually published their transparency measures on their own website and in their own materials. So, giant round of applause to Starbucks for being transparent and for saying that they're going to publish their own accountability measures. That is fabulous. So, I'm excited. Hope everybody else is excited. And I hope more companies follow suit, because when companies reach pay parity, they make more money. It's not just the right thing to do. We have lots of measures that when there are more women in leadership, when there is more equitable treatment of everybody in a corporation, that that corporation makes more money across all measures. So this is the right thing to do, the smart thing to do, and people make more money. It's win-win-win.
Kristen Rauffink-Beiner, thank you so much for coming in and talking about this.
Thank you.
And we'll continue to talk about this, because this is just the beginning. Kristen is the co-founder of the advocacy group Moms Rising. She's also the CEO and executive director. And if you are listening and thinking about your own questions, your own experiences with negotiating for pay, with pay equity where you work, please get in touch with us. You can tweet us at KUOW, email us, record@kuow.org. That's record@kuow.org.
Aurora Avenue North is a car place. You can buy a car there, sell a car, get fancy rims for your tires. For decades, Aurora's business community has been dominated by car-oriented businesses. That time is coming to an end, and those businesses are fighting to maintain what influence they have left. Joshua McNichols of KUOW's Region of Boom team reports from 92nd and Aurora.
Meet Randy Sturm. He works at Abra Auto Body, and his shop's location on Aurora is just perfect. It's got high visibility, and there's been an auto shop at this intersection for decades. Sturm has seen some pretty nasty car wrecks rolling.
What's the most extreme example of one of those?
Oh, I could show you a picture, but we're not allowed to share that. But
I talked him into it.
The whole side of the car's gone, the roof's gone. Everything's gone other than the firewall. There would be nothing left. And you basically have to build the car from base up. And you build it like how the robots do. You know, there's a lot of procedures and policies we gotta follow. They take photos of every weld.
But he spares the customers the gory details.
Do they know how much their car had to go through?
Nope.
They get their car back, they don't even notice the difference.
It's gotten harder to operate on Aurora lately. Abra used to park its wrecked cars on the side streets, but people slept in them, and neighbors complained. Attitudes towards car-oriented businesses are shifting in other ways, too. People have told the city they don't want these businesses to grow here anymore. Instead, they want places to live, with retail shops on the ground floor. The city council is listening to these voices, and zoning changes on the horizon give those voices legal weight.
We're being pushed out of the city, and we're not allowed to have auto-related businesses in these urban villages, even though we're abutting Aurora.
That's Russ Saunders, who owns Handy Andy, a truck rental business on Aurora that's been in his family for 40 years. Recently, he bought an auto wrecking yard next door because he wants to store his trucks there. Right now, he parks them on the street, and they've been getting vandalized. But he says because of the planned zoning changes, he's now fighting for the life of his business.
If I get my permits before these zoning changes, I will be grandfathered in, which will allow me to stay at my business. If I don't get my new permits, I will lose everything.
Other car-oriented businesses are cashing out. Lincoln Towing, on 125th in Aurora, is building 125 new townhomes on its former tow lot. This is a major shift. Cars are out. Housing is in. That's elicited a cry of pain from the Aurora Merchants Association and its wealthy benefactor, Faye Garneau.
The idea of building apartments on a major highway in this country is ridiculous. It'd be like putting apartments on the freeway.
Garneau says nobody wants to live on a freeway.
You can try all you want to make it into a little neighborhood street, but it isn't. It's a major highway.
Garneau and her late husband, Ed, built a fortune fixing cars on Aurora. They used to own the shop Abra Auto Body's in now, plus many others. They started way back in the late 1950s.
So we've been here a long time.
So you were here before the World's Fair?
Yes, we were.
She says Aurora has always been about cars. And not just Aurora.
This is America. Everybody has a car. I mean, the first thing kids want to do when they get out of high school is get themselves a car, you know. They might not be able to afford it, but that's what they want. They get a job, they get a car.
But young people have been shifting their interest away from cars lately. The nonprofit Forterra took a poll of Seattle millennials last year, and it found there's something else young people want much more than cars. Affordable housing. Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
And that is our next pit stop on our series, Along the Mother Road. We're going to meet people who are trying to rebuild Aurora as a place for housing. You'll find all of our stories at KUOW.org. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Well, have you deleted your Facebook yet? Last week, alarm bells were ringing as we learned about the data Facebook has on us and what they can do with it. We found out that a British marketing company used Facebook data to build personality profiles of its users. This marketing firm, Cambridge Analytica, would sell that personality profile to politicians like Donald Trump, promising that this information could win votes. But was that ever really true? Can Facebook data swing elections? Are they that good? Our next guest knows a lot about ad targeting. Antonio Garcia Martinez helped Facebook figure out how user data can point ads at you. He now writes for Wired Magazine. Welcome, Antonio.
Thanks for having me on the show.
What is this supposedly powerful information that Cambridge Analytica got from Facebook users?
Yeah, I would maybe take a little bit of issue with how powerful it was. What Cambridge Analytica did was it effectively paid users to opt into what's called the Facebook app. And with that app, in addition to the sort of personality quiz they had you take, they sucked out, it's not exactly clear, but more than likely it was your Facebook likes, basically the pages you've liked on Facebook. And then they built a model that in some sense tried to correlate things you'd liked with one of five personality types, which in turn was correlated with views on particular push-button issues like immigration, guns, Trump, Brexit, etc. So that was sort of what they were trying to mush together with the data that they effectively stole from Facebook.
Yes, you use the phrase mush together, which suggests your skepticism at this whole idea that your likes and other data really tells companies so much about you. Tell us why you're skeptical.
Well, because, this is already a settled issue. I mean, this is what we realized when I was at Facebook in 2011, 2012. We were trying to milk Facebook user data for all it was worth. I mean, that was my mandate. And the conclusion we came to is that some Facebook data is, you know, good but basic. Age, geography, gender, for example, tends to be fairly accurate, but that's not very powerful by and large. Things like, you know, Facebook likes, the fact that you've liked BMW's page, say, 2 years ago, doesn't mean you're actually about to buy a BMW. That's the reality of it. And so, I mean, it's precisely because that data kind of doesn't work in the way that these advertisers want that we launch products that advertisers definitely do use. And in fact, the Trump campaign did use to try to reach voters. And there, it's a thing called custom audiences and a few other tools. And there, it's really not Facebook data that's being used to target you an ad. Facebook is really just doing a join to outside data. I mean, the political case, voter rolls, donor records. In the more sort of mundane commercial case, websites you've looked at, your email address, for example. And so the outside advertiser then joins to Facebook, but it's really not Facebook's data that's being used to target you with an ad, because by and large, Facebook doesn't have that data. It doesn't know what's in your shopping cart at Amazon. It doesn't know what car you drive. It doesn't know what groceries you bought at Safeway. And so that's why, you know, the argument that Facebook can just swing an election based on its own data, it kind of rings hollow to a lot of advertising professionals.
So are you saying Facebook users ought to calm down and not worry about this?
Well, I mean, depends what you're worrying about. Yeah, I don't think, if we're going to make a movie about this, I don't think Facebook is the bad guy, right? I mean, I think, there's definitely a sort of user reaction against browsing on the internet for a pair of shoes, and then you instantly see that same pair of shoes inside Facebook. And the first conclusion they jump to is, oh, Facebook knows everything I do. I mean, in that actual case, and this is literally what happens, Facebook doesn't actually know that you browse for shoes, but it does build technology that allows an advertiser to stick an ad in there. And so if you're really worried about that sort of thing, the reality is you should be worried about, you know, the Amazons or the Zappos or the various other players in the world. Facebook, at the end of the day, it's really kind of a paid messaging platform. It's not, I know that it's hard to kind of break the connection between the ad and the Facebook logo you're staring at on your phone, but the way advertising works, those two aren't necessarily coupled in the same way that people think they are.
What about the concern we heard? I interviewed last week a computer scientist who helps build AI, artificial intelligence profiles, and she said she regularly gets requests from companies who want to buy data that will suggest that you are more likely to be depressed, be addicted, have a pre-existing medical condition, that companies, they seem to be confident about this information because they want to buy tools that tell them who they might steer away from hiring. Are you saying that's all, it would be a waste of money?
Oh, yeah. I mean, here's the reality. In advertising technology, it doesn't actually have to work for you to be able to sell it, right? I mean, Cambridge Analytica evidently had a whole business in this. That doesn't mean that it actually works, right? I mean, here's the problem with what that academic says, right? I mean, Cambridge Analytica's work was actually, you know, built on peer-reviewed academic research, right? And that's one area, you know, I'm not a trained psychologist, I'm not going to comment on that. But what I do know about is the actual targeting side of it. How do you actually do something based on that model, right? No matter what the model is, whether it's a personality quiz, or something as simple as saying, hey, look, here's my model. I think people with lots of money who want a BMW will buy a BMW, right? Very simple model. I could go out and ask 100,000 people a poll and ask them to give me their tax returns, and it turns out that my model predicts better than random chance that, in fact, rich people who want BMWs will buy BMWs. But what do I do with that? How do I find a rich person on Facebook? How do I find an interest in BMW on Facebook? You know, the Facebook likes just don't get you there. You'd need some other piece of data. You'd need the dealer records, for example, from either BMW dealerships or comparable dealerships. You need some outside data that Facebook doesn't know. And that's, in some sense, you know, why me and other people express a lot of skepticism around Cambridge, because fine, you pay people to take a quiz and maybe you can surmise something about their personality. But what do you do with that? How do you find a neurotic person on Facebook? The challenge is the same, right? And it's actually not as easy to do as either Cambridge Analytica let on in their sales pitch, obviously, or as I think the media is describing right now.
What is your evidence that these personality profiles are so wrong? I mean, are you finding profiles about people you know perfectly well don't match that profile at all?
My proof is that nobody uses them, right? I mean, talk to any marketer who spends money for a living on Facebook. And psychographics, which is sort of the marketing buzzword for this, is not commonly used as a tool on Facebook. I mean, I have written for Wired about the tools that Trump most certainly did use to swing the election. And again, those are based on having outside data like voter rolls, knowing who donors were, for example. Those, you know, I'm not saying Facebook advertising is ineffective. It absolutely can swing an election or get you to buy a pair of shoes, surely. But I don't think some convoluted, you know, psychological model in which you're using Facebook's weakest targeting data to model this convoluted thing, which maybe is associated with this other thing, I don't think that most people who actually buy and sell ads for a living kind of buy that story.
Okay. Cambridge Analytica did not help get Donald Trump elected president.
I do think Facebook did, to be clear. But yeah. Cambridge Analytica in particular, no.
Yeah. We're talking with Antonio Garcia Martinez, and he wrote this piece for Wired magazine about his skepticism of our concern about personality profiles and Facebook data scraping. So Facebook announced today, I just saw, that it's updating its privacy settings. Should we trust Facebook on that?
Well, I'm laughing because they do this like every year or two.
Yeah, basically. That's what I thought.
No, you're absolutely right. That's an absolute. If your listeners are thinking, "Hey, isn't this? Haven't I heard this before?" It's true. They have. It's a good and a bad thing. Look, I mean, from what I've seen, what they've changed is they've made the user interface kind of easier and more intuitive, right? But here's the perennial problem, and this is true. If you went back to Facebook even before the most recent change, users could have locked down their data from Cambridge Analytica's data snooping. The tools have always been there, right? It's just users tend not to understand or not care, frankly, until the crisis happens, how privacy works on Facebook. And so what they just launched, at least from what I can tell, is nothing, it's not at all different. Nothing's really changed fundamentally with Facebook's privacy tools. They're just easier to find, and they're kind of prompting you to kind of, hey, look, maybe you kind of want to lock down your data if you really care about it. But yeah, I mean, nothing's really fundamentally changed.
So, Antonio, have you gone into those tools and changed your profile and used all those settings so you're safe, or have you deleted your Facebook app? What are you doing?
No, because again, I'm not particularly protective of a lot of the personal data on Facebook, because again, it's not used that much to actually target ads. I think people just don't understand that the actual attack vector, if they're really paranoid. Believe it or not, say, for example, when you go to Safeway and you use your Safeway discount card, which is keyed by a phone number, they're tracking you via that. They're absolutely tracking you via the fact that you just bought diapers or beer or whatever. That is being used on Facebook. Facebook doesn't know that, but Safeway does, right? Or you can name many other retailers. So there's all these other touch points where, in fact, you're being tracked. And I think it's hard to escape the conclusion that I think Facebook is serving as kind of a scapegoat for all these worries and concerns, because it's this one company that's being kind of trumped up by the media. But again, this, at least in the United States, this tracking is kind of ubiquitous, and it's hard to escape unless you live in a cabin in the woods.
You used to work for Facebook, right?
Yeah.
You're not getting paid for them now, though. Paid by
no,
them.
No.
I'm just checking.
Oh, no, of course not. Are you kidding? My book, are you kidding? I broke all codes of silence and, in fact, was very critical in my book. No, there's no old Facebook guy kind of supporting the old company here. I mean, I do think there are reasons to criticize Facebook and how they dealt with the scandal, frankly. I mean, I think it took them a long time to react, right? They knew about the Cambridge Analytica thing for at least 2 years. I mean, the story broke a few weeks ago, but it's been around for a couple of years.
Yep.
I think you can definitely criticize Facebook about this. I mean, the company I knew, frankly, what surprised me, if you're asking me as an old Facebooker, the thing that surprised me is how sort of passive Facebook was in the face of a potential data breach. The company I knew would have acted very aggressively with any outside company that seemed as if it was either misusing or hoovering out Facebook data. Because again, even if you assume Facebook is perfectly evil, and I know there are many people who do, they have no interest and having their data get stolen or selling their data in the sense of giving it away to somebody else. I mean, that is what's propping up their, $300 billion market cap. They have no interest in having that get out. So the company I knew was way more aggressive about clamping this sort of thing down. And it does kind of surprise me how long it took them to shut down Cambridge Analytica.
Mark Zuckerberg said that Facebook and other tech companies should probably be more regulated. What kind of regulations do you think we'll actually see?
I think that's actually a good point. I think one of the key things here, one of the key reasons why people are really freaking out about it and why they're sort of suddenly learning about these technologies now. I mean, everything that I just mentioned, custom audiences, all that stuff is at least 5 years old. There's nothing new in terms of Facebook's ads offering here. But I think that the key thing is that, politicians are suddenly starting to use the same very savvy, somewhat invasive ads targeting strategies that the commercial world has used for years. And I think people react very differently when those techniques are used to sell you a pair of shoes versus when they're used to sell you Trump, right? That's the big deal. And so it's clear to me, I think, that, the political world is fundamentally different than the commercial world. It is the case that, for example, not on the internet, but on TV and radio, there actually are very prescriptive rules about how political advertising works. And if those rules were extended to the internet, I don't think that would be a bad thing. In fact, that may just be what Facebook needs, to be honest. And so to the extent that we control how that data works on the political side, there should be regulation there. Maybe even something like an equal time, equal cost rule as exists on the TV side. I think all of that is definitely worth exploring in the context of Facebook.
So bottom line, Antonio, any advice for listeners? We're wondering, what should I do? I want to be secure. I want to get the stuff I want online for free. What should we do?
Right. That's the key thing, for free. Right. Facebook is not free to provide. It's something like a quarter of the internet in terms of bandwidth, and it's very expensive to maintain. I don't know what to tell that listener. If you have a problem with giving away some of your data in exchange for a free and entertaining media experience, then you're not going to like the 21st century very much, because the reality is that on the consumer internet, advertising still reigns as the leading business model, and I don't see that changing. So I think the only thing I could say is, I don't know, get used to it, maybe.
Even if I did delete Facebook, just very quickly, and if I didn't delete Instagram and WhatsApp that they also own, would it make any difference if I deleted Facebook?
No, it won't, actually, because a key part of Facebook's thing is that it knows who you are and every device you touch. And so if you're actively using Instagram, they're still going to track you. They're still going to join you to all this custom audiences tracking that I'm talking about. That all still works on Instagram as well. I think they're holding up Facebook as a scapegoat. Google does all of this as well. The Apple and Android app ecosystems leak data like crazy. Everyone knows this. I mean, this is happening kind of everywhere in the online space. But for some reason, again, Facebook seems to come up as the bad guy usually.
Okay, get used to it, says Antonio Garcia Martinez, who now writes for Wired Magazine. He's a former Facebook manager for ads and the author of Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. Antonio, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
You know, here at KUOW, we get a lot of questions about traffic in this region, and one question stuck out to reporter Anna Boyko-Wyrock.
One listener asked, what's going on with all the road construction and traffic in Tacoma along I-5? It feels like it has never not been a construction zone. The listener wanted to be anonymous, but a few others had the same question. So I drove to the area. A few miles on either side of the Tacoma Dome are under construction right now. It's part of a bigger effort to totally revamp the highway network in Pierce County to add HOV lanes. The idea is to let carpools and buses get through faster so everyone on the roads can have smoother sailing. Eventually.
We are pretty much bumper-to-bumper traffic.
I'm in the car with Quinn Width. For some drivers in the region, it seems like these projects have lasted a lifetime. And if you're in your 20s like her, they have. You might say Quinn and the roads have grown up together. As a teen, she sang to cope with traffic.
And now I just kind of am thinking about things like, what's my next project for the house? I don't turn the music up full volume and pretend I'm Mariah Carey anymore.
This construction dates back even further than Mariah Carey. To 1993. Whitney Houston topped the charts, Quinn was in preschool, and the Washington State Department of Transportation first recommended HOV lanes in Tacoma. But it took 8 years before they got the funding and broke ground. The first step was rebuilding an overpass by the Tacoma Mall. 6 years later, the first HOV lanes in the county opened on a stretch of Highway 16 that snakes through Tacoma, but not on I-5 yet. By that time, Quinn was 18 and living on her own.
So, I got a taste of how hard real life actually can be with having to work all the time and bills and paying for my own food.
But the construction still wasn't done. I put the listeners' questions to the guy responsible for these projects, John Winans with the Washington State Department of Transportation. He says a lot of people ask why it's taking so long.
What I say is that, you work within the budget that you're allocated.
He says the legislature funded the projects one bit at a time, around $400 million at a time. But the whole thing costs $1.6 billion. Winans says it's like this.
We're building something that costs $100 and we're being told that we're going to get $10 a year. And so it's going to take us 10 years.
Besides cash flow, another challenge, sorry drivers, is you. They can't just close I-5 and rebuild everything at once.
If we had all the funding at the beginning and we could close I-5 and rebuild it, you could probably get through it in you're still looking years.
After all, it's not just one construction project. It's also bridges, on-ramps, off-ramps, and retaining walls. Retired State Secretary of Transportation Doug McDonald gave me his perspective.
It's like trying to do a remodel in a restaurant kitchen while you're trying to keep the entire flow of guests in the restaurant.
I also called up an outside expert, Keith Molinar, who's a construction engineering professor at the University of Colorado. Molinar says these are complex projects, so it's not surprising that it takes decades.
It is really difficult to expedite things. The only thing you can really do to move things along faster is to spend more money on it.
And Molinar says he thinks Washington's transportation department does a good job.
Washington's one of the more efficient departments of transportation in the country, in my perspective.
I hold back, sometimes I won't. Now it's 25 years later. Drake is at the top of the charts, and Quinn has a degree, a husband, and a house. And the construction still isn't done.
Anytime I have to drive to Tacoma, I'm like, oh man.
The State Transportation Department says the current construction projects will be done in 2021. But they have other HOV projects in mind just south of there. They just don't have the money yet. In Tacoma, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock, KUOW News.
Do you have a news question for KUOW reporters? Tweet it to us, at KUOW. A waiter in Vancouver, BC, claims he was fired for being too French. Here with that story is our friend Vaughn Palmer, columnist with the Vancouver Sun. Hi, Vaughn.
Hey, Bill. Everyone loves this story.
Is there such a thing as being too French?
Too French and too rude. You know, I think immediately people think of the classic stereotype of the French waiter. But the odd thing about this case, well, there's two things that are unusual. The first is that the fellow is not accused of being rude to the customers in the restaurant. He's accused of being rude to the other staff, of being aggressive in the way he supervised them. The second thing that's unusual about it is he's gone to the Human Rights Tribunal in British Columbia and made a preliminary case that there's something here that needs to be looked into. He's claiming that his French heritage and culture makes him more direct and a little less inhibited than your typically polite Canadian, and therefore he's being judged unfairly by his culture and background. The tribunal has ruled, Bill, that there's a case here worth hearing. He still has to make his case, but it's kind of it's a little like one of those prima facie cases. Okay, well, hear you out. We'll have a proper hearing on this. Whether he'll survive the complaint is another matter.
Well, how do you think Canadians tend to perceive the French? We're not talking about French Canadians here, by the way.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? I mean, look, I think there's, you know, Canadians know the stereotype like everybody else. I don't think it's as strong a stereotype about French Canadians. I mean, Canadians, I'm sure French Canadians have stereotypes about English Canadians and vice versa, but we tend to think about things like poutine and that, not so much about being rude to people in restaurants the way they supposedly are in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to Google this story online. It's been picked up by all the British papers, right? Because, you know, they know the stereotype too. So I don't know how it's being covered in France. My knowledge doesn't extend to Canada's other official language, so I don't know if it's been picked up there, but it's certainly got attention in Canada. And it's an unusual case. The Human Rights Tribunal has the power to order him reinstated. They have the power to impose fines. So it's a real legitimate process. And I have to think the actual hearing will be closely followed by students of cultural differences.
In more of French manners news, Vaughn, I see the Canadian government just ruled that radio and TV stations in French language can say the F word.
Yeah, what happened here, actually, the most recent thing is a complaint to the ombudsman for the CBC, some woman who said she was driving in her car and the F word was used twice during a live interview on CBC radio, and complained that children shouldn't have to hear the F word while driving around with their parents in their car. CBC's line of defense, which was upheld by the ombudsman, was that, first of all, they put out a warning that there'd be strong language during the interview. Of course, the trouble with radio, as you know, Bill, is it's a dynamic medium. If you don't hear the warning at the beginning, you can still hear the words. They justified the use of the words in this interview on the grounds that it was two women speaking, using strong language to describe their complaints of sexual harassment against the director of a theater company. And the CBC concluded that the strength of the language they were using here conveyed some of the outrage and humiliation that the women felt. So they used it, although they did put a warning at the front end. And that's generally the rule in broadcasting here in Canada, both radio and TV. You can use these words, the famous seven words that George Carlin did in an entire monologue, but you do have to let people know it's coming, and you have to have a good reason. It can't be gratuitous.
Thank you for the well-thought-out words, Vaughn Palmer from Vancouver Sound. Good to talk with you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Thanks for listening. The show is made for you by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Coming up tomorrow, does Seattle have a signature dish? Should we come up with a signature Seattle dish? I'm Bill Radke. Join us then. Thanks for listening.